I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Albert Migliori. He is a physicist and laboratory fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he will be speaking in a presentation called Renewable Energy, Save It or Lose It. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, MC. That's wonderful to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, this is a fascinating and extremely important problem, and I think it's very important to define the problem. When we talk about getting off of fossil fuels for a million reasons that we don't even need to go into right now, and using renewable fuels, using clean energy, there is an issue, which is we can generate this stuff all we want, but solar energy you can only generate in the day, wind energy you can only generate best at certain times of year. What do you do to get that energy, not when it's being produced by Mother Nature, but when we need it?
Well, the wonderful thing here is that the science problem for us is so clearly defined. We know how to make electricity from wind. We might be refining that over the next decade or two, but we do a really good job of getting electricity from the wind into a bunch of electrical wires. We can do the same with solar. We know how to make electricity from sunlight, either photovoltaics or running a bunch of mirrors and a boiler, but we can do it. But that we have no technology that can store enough energy to take the output, for example, of the wind farms in New Mexico in the spring at night, where we have huge amounts of wind energy, and carry them to August in Albuquerque in the summer when the air conditioning loads go up. That doesn't exist today. That technology is missing.
And it's amazing that it's missing, because all of us have flashlights that have batteries, and we have cell phones that have batteries, and we think that electricity storage is just a given.
Well, just think about the flashlight batteries and the pile of dead batteries you'd have if you tried to use that for grid storage. Even if you have rechargeable batteries, every cubic centimeter of a battery is expensive, as you well know when you try and buy either the regular ones or the rechargeable ones. So even if I make fancy new batteries, you're never going to drive, for example, a semi from Chicago to Los Angeles on batteries. So you're stuck with trying to solve a problem where the costs, the efficiencies, and the energy densities are far, far away from what any battery can do. And that means liquid chemical fuels.
So let's back up for a moment and talk about all the different ways that we know of, or more accurately, that you know of, being a physicist, that energy can be stored.
So there are only two ways from the fundamental physicist's point of view, which is kind of where I'm coming from here today. And that is as kinetic energy, that is the energy of motion.
What does that look like, kinetic energy? What do you mean?
So if you think of a roller coaster, at the top of the hill, just before it starts, all the energy that that roller coaster has for the rest of the ride is captured in the height above ground. And that's potential energy in a gravitational field. And a field is a magic concept in physics, and there are very, very few of them. There's just gravitational, electrical sorts of fields like electricity and magnetism, and the strong nuclear forces. So there are very few fields in the precise definition that can store energy, but that's one way. The other way is the energy of motion. That roller coaster starts, and it's not losing much energy as it goes, otherwise it'd never make it around the track. So when it gets to the bottom of that first hill and it's really screaming, all that energy that you had put into the gravitational field by lifting it is now converted to the energy of motion. And so that's it. I have potential energy at the top of the hill, kinetic energy of motion at the bottom. And that's all physics lets us do.
And so, staying with kinetic energy for a moment, if you were to roll a whole lot of things up hills with your wind energy, and then when you needed that energy, you could roll them down hills, that would be an energy source.
That would be an energy storage mechanism, yeah, and it would work. The problem is that, if I took a sport utility vehicle in a mile deep shaft in the ground, and I lowered that sport utility vehicle a mile down the ground, I'd only run a 100-watt light bulb for a day or so with that energy. So what I've got to lift...
So you need a very huge amount of... You basically have to lift a huge amount of mass up in order to get any significant amount of energy bringing it back down.
Right. So think Hoover Dam. I've got to lift an entire lake, hundreds of square miles, up hundreds of feet to get the amount of energy storage I need to be comparable to the output of a U.S. electrical generating plant.
And so using solar and wind to generate that kind of energy isn't really practical when you think about kinetic energy.
I have to be a little careful there. So the problem is it's real hard to put Hoover Dam in Sierra County, New Mexico. So I can't really use that unless Mother Nature's already provided me with that energy storage. But if I had it, I could use it. It'd be just fine. And I could dump all the solar and wind I could make in New Mexico to pumping water uphill, but we can't really build that. So we've got to find technical solutions to this problem.
And technical solutions, we're not just talking New Mexico, we're talking the whole country, we're talking the whole world.
Yeah, we are. And it'd be really nice if these solutions were ones that could be applied anywhere, rather than needing a specific geological structure to make it work.
Okay, so that's kinetic energy. Let's move on. There's other kinds of energy storage. You were talking about the, how would you call the energy stored in batteries?
So we're going to go back to strictly potential energy. That is the energy stored by lifting that roller coaster to the top of the first hill. Well, you know, I can pull electrical charges apart because they want to attract each other. A positive and negative charge really love each other and they want to stick together. If I pull them apart, I took energy to do that. And when I release them, if I cook up something cool, I can recover that energy that it took to pull them apart, and out comes electricity. Chemicals are exactly that. If I can pump electricity into some magic black box and make a chemical, which I've made now by pulling charges from some molecules and attaching them to others by some magic of electrochemistry, and then later I can take those chemicals and I can run them through a fuel cell and recover electrical energy, and I can do other things with those chemicals as well. But in that case, it's the electric field that I'm using to store the energy, and we call it chemistry, but at the atomic level, the molecular level, it's really only the potential energy of an electric field. So I want to make chemicals.
What are some of the examples in real life that illustrate what you're saying?
Just another driver for making chemicals. If you consider the battery again, every cubic centimeter of that battery is expensive. But I can build a storage tank that holds 1 million gallons by welding steel plate together. And if I can fill it with a useful chemical, 1 million gallon storage tank can run Albuquerque for hours, days, and make an electricity. So that's the very cheapest energy storage mechanism possible, is a big steel tank.
And the question is, what's in that big steel tank? And that's, I mean, we've been using up our fossil fuels. Those are very efficient sources of energy for the exact reasons that you're talking about.
Absolutely.
But they have other not so wonderful properties, namely carbon production, pollution, things like that.
Absolutely. So we're not going to run on carbon-based fossil fuels forever. And it's time now to be working on converting ourselves to renewable energy while we still can, before we're so broke and polluted that it becomes harder and harder. So what do we do? What do we want to make? Well, you know, there's the popular one of a few years ago of making hydrogen. But hydrogen's really trouble. It's a huge problem is that you can't store it. It's an explosive, flammable gas.
And so you don't exactly want it in the back of your car.
Well, especially because in the back of your car, you're going to store it in a storage tank that has 12,000 pounds per square inch of pressure, built by the lowest bidder for the automotive industry. You can drive that, but I'm going to bicycle. So we need to have liquid chemicals, and we need to have liquid chemicals that can only be made from electricity. And they have to be chemicals so that once I make them, I can leave them in my storage tank for 20 years, and later I can pull them out and make electricity from those chemicals at reasonable efficiency.
And if you're making them, let's say, from the wind farms in New Mexico, let's say that you find some, we'll talk about what this might be, but let's say you find a way to make this kind of wonderful, energy-rich, liquid chemical from electricity, from a process involving, let's say, wind turbines. And you then have this liquid. It has to be transportable. It has to be non-explosive. It has to be non-polluting.
Well, it only has to beat gasoline. It doesn't have to be...
It has to beat gasoline. It has to be better than gasoline.
Yeah, it can be just a little less explosive and flammable than gasoline. It could be a little less toxic and carcinogenic than gasoline. Well, then I'm home free because I've made something better. So what do we want to make? There's a bunch of choices, but my favorite today, and I'm working very hard at Los Alamos to make this a reality, is to produce ammonia. That's a surprise. But if you think about ammonia, it's the second most produced industrial chemical today, although it's not produced from electricity, so it's not used to store energy. But we have the storage and the distribution networks already in place for ammonia. And ammonia is the most important fertilizer for growing crops. So if I can take a wind farm or a solar thermal plant or anything, even a coal-fired or a gas-fired power plant, and run that energy into making ammonia, then sometime later, after I store it in a big cheap steel tank, I can run it through a fuel cell and make electricity. I can burn it in a diesel engine and make a car or a tractor go. And this was done earlier in the last century.
They ran
tractors
on ammonia.
On ammonia, because they were pumping it into the ground and they had big storage tanks on their farms anyway, so they used it as diesel fuel. And I can pump it in the ground and grow crops. So I've got a fuel for engines, a chemical for fuel cells, and a fertilizer. It just looks wonderful to me.
And so what's in the way?
What's in the way is we can't make it efficiently. But the cool thing about that is that there isn't a single physical law that says we shouldn't be able to do this. But unfortunately, even though there's 250 years of electrochemistry behind us, it's only recently that the imperative to make something like ammonia from electricity has become critically important, and that the scientific tools that let you look at chemistry right down to the molecular level have become widespread and available. So we're at kind of a revolutionary time at the juncture between chemistry and physics, where we have a shot at studying these processes and understanding them well enough to make them happen at levels that solve large-scale energy storage problems. You know, you might say grid scale, but I don't want to really restrict it to what today we think of as grid scale, because these could be distributed. You're not going to have one in your basement, but you might have one for the whole block.
Well, this is something that I wanted to talk to you about. We're talking to Albert Migliori, who's a physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. It seems that when conversations happen about our energy future, they always seem to go to super micro or super macro, namely utility scale energy on the one hand, which involves transporting energy over long distances, which means energy loss in that transportation, or putting panels on your house, which is expensive and has some non-economies of scale. But nobody ever seems to talk about municipal scale, or very few people seem to be talking about municipal scale, or as you just said, neighborhood scale clean energy projects.
So I love the idea of that. And as long as the physics and the thermodynamics are dealt with properly, there's kind of a minimum size for energy storage systems, at least the ones I'm thinking of. I don't want to go into a lot of deep detail here, but that minimum size is definitely not grid scale. I'd love to be able to store all the energy from the 206-megawatt wind farm in southern New Mexico, but it might be that I really only have to store the energy from a few wind turbines at each spot, and that has beautiful consequences. One is that I don't have to build a new distribution network. That is, I don't have to string power lines, huge capacity power lines from renewable energy sources to energy users.
So if you had more localized, smaller users. Little utilities, so
and,
to speak.
And as long as I get over the inefficiencies that come in on very small electrical stuff, you know, as soon as I get pretty big, I'm okay. I should be able to do it efficiently. And, of course, the more distributed it is, the more robust the utility grid is against outages and failures.
Right.
And the less strain I put on transmission lines. And, in fact, it's easier to build. Think about the economics problem. I want to suddenly, I'm this great inventor, and I've suddenly invented this new gadget that makes ammonia from electricity at 70% efficiency. By the way, if we pull that off, game over. We've saved the world.
And really?
There's no physical law that says we can't do it.
And you're working on it at Los Alamos, and ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first.
Okay. So let's say we pull this off, and I make this magic gadget. Well, if I start distributing it, at first it might be a smaller gadget. You might have one of these for every 2.5 megawatt wind turbine. So it becomes an integral part of the wind turbine when you put it up. But you know, it's wonderful because once I have this gadget, whatever scale it is, you know, it won't be tiny, but I've got now an energy source tied to the energy generator that I can leak energy into the grid just when I want it. And I can keep nuclear and coal at a minimum and really change the entire economic landscape of energy production, I think.
There's another dimension in this which goes outside of science and physics, and that is, it's just issues of power and economics, which is when you have one utility that owns everything and energy production and what they can charge us and so on is very concentrated in very few hands. The possibility for political corruption is right there, and it's inevitable.
You know, I'm a physicist, so I've failed to understand economics for 40 years or more now. But it seems to me that if the device that I eventually use, or the technology I use to store energy, is smaller but not tiny, then lots of them can be built by lots of people. And the ability to monopolize goes down.
Although, Lord knows they'll try.
I'm not competent.
Yeah.
To push that thought for the moment, but you know, it's been very hard to justify huge wind turbines. For example, for a long time, a lot of small wind turbines were cheaper than one big one. The only thing that's letting the very big turbines work today are certain advances in materials and bearings and blades. But in fact, there's kind of a sweet spot. And I don't know where the sweet spot is for energy storage, but there are so many economic issues that I can't get my head around, that it seems to me that that distributed medium-scale energy storage would be a gorgeous solution to
now,
our problems.
There's something that gets talked about a lot, which is, okay, as we start out the conversation, the sun only shines during the day, and so what do you do about the energy you need at night? And the wind tends to blow most in the spring, and so what do you do in the summer when it's really still? And so those are very big variations in energy production. Then you have the opposite when you have coal and nuclear plants, which produce a very steady stream of energy. No matter what, it doesn't. They can't just turn it up and down the way you would the volume on a, you know, on your radio or something like that. And we still vary the amount of energy we need depending on the time of day and the season. And so that ends up being kind of another. It's like the other side of the same problem.
Yeah. So when I run a nuclear power plant or a coal-fired power plant, in fact, think about the San Juan Generating Station in the northwest corner of New Mexico. There are four units there, you know, a couple of 500 megawatt and a couple of 350 megawatt coal-fired power plants. They're running carburetors that are two stories high that blow coal dust into giant burners. So to change the electrical output of one of those plants, the operator's got this throttle that's about 2 feet long, and he just pulls on this, and half an hour later, the output of the generating plant changes. So you can't suddenly change the power output of a coal-fired or a nuclear power plant. But here's the problem. So I got a wind farm, and the wind suddenly comes up, and I start to try and generate 200 megawatts of wind energy, say, or 50 megawatts, or whatever it is. What do I do? Because I can't suddenly have, a 1,000 megawatt load in New Mexico that is, for the moment, the entire state is using, say, 1,000 megawatts. And suddenly I start producing another 100. Where does it go? Where does it go?
And nobody ever thinks about that. Where does it go?
Well, the problem is, if I want to keep the wind turbines running, I've got to shut down the coal plants. Well, I can't do it.
Or turn down the level on the coal plants.
And so if I slow the output of a coal plant, its efficiency goes down, and I actually generate more carbon at lower loads than I would at full throttle. So what utilities do is they have a base load, coal and nuclear, then they have things like gas turbines that have a very high response speed. So I can turn back quickly the gas turbine and let the wind energy come up, and that works great until I produce more wind energy than those gas turbines can produce, and then I can't backpedal fast enough, and I'm in big trouble, and the only thing I can do is shut down the turbines. That's a shame. Real shame.
Yeah.
So one really would love to have energy storage so I can run a bunch of smaller coal-fired power plants at full throttle all the time at the maximum efficiency until I straighten out life in the universe. And anytime wind comes up, I don't have to backpedal on anything. I just dump the excess energy straight into an energy storage device. I make ammonia, put it in a big cheap tank, wait for 6 months until I need it.
So ammonia is one possibility, and it's obviously the one that you're working on at Los Alamos. What are some other possibilities for energy storage that you think have some potential?
Well, we kind of dismissed hydrogen, but there are other chemicals like methanol, for example, where there are, in fact, natural sources of methanol, and it's a well-used industrial chemical. It could be made as well, and it's no more toxic, flammable, explosive than ammonia, and less so than gasoline. And there's then a list of more obscure chemicals.
So in your view, however this question is resolved, it will be resolved through some kind of liquid chemical.
Yeah.
That
no,
can be
no qualifications to that answer.
Very
yes.
Interesting. And there's not all that many candidates that we know of.
Yeah, but we're pretty good at not seeing disruptive technology either. So I certainly wouldn't restrict the vision for future liquid chemicals that can store electrical energy.
That we just simply haven't even contemplated yet.
But I just love ammonia. Again, you run it in a diesel engine, make the car go, run it in a fuel cell, make electricity directly, stuff it in the ground and grow crops. How could you lose?
Yeah. So there are, I looked on the Wikipedia page on energy storage methods, and there's a lot of things on here, like springs, like mechanical methods, flywheels and things like that, tensing up a spring and then letting it go and things like that, and thermal storage, solar ponds and hot bricks and all kinds of stuff like that. And Lord knows people in places like Santa Fe, when they build their house, will make a brick floor and a brick wall that will store their sunlight so that they can sleep warm at night, and the next day it happens all over again. Where do those kinds of methods fit into your thinking about energy storage?
So let me preface that by saying that every single viable method of electrical energy storage, thermal energy storage, is going to be used in the coming century. Everything. The special place that liquid fuels have is that they are also usable for transportation. And one should think extremely carefully about where batteries and liquid fuels will be in transportation in the coming decades. Batteries will work under limited urban circumstances. They certainly have a pollution load in producing, making, and disposing of them.
Yeah, but batteries are not really your poster child for a low carbon footprint.
No, but they work. And they work in reducing the total carbon output if we solve some of the manufacturing problems. So they'll be used, but you will never, I say again, you'll never drive a tractor semi-trailer from Chicago to Los Angeles on batteries.
Why can't you, if you can refill your tank with gas, why can't you stop and recharge your battery?
There are a bunch of technical reasons that make that not going to happen. First, the weight of batteries has to be a reasonable fraction of the weight of the vehicle. So if I'm going to transport goods in a truck, I have to have a really big, heavy battery. When I go to recharge that, you cannot charge batteries really fast without harming them because of heat, etc. But another subtlety that people don't realize is that if I wanted to put all the energy back into that battery that I just got, that I just pulled out by driving across the state of Illinois with the truck, that's a huge energy flow, and it would require a utility grid that could deliver huge peak loads to charge that battery quickly. And that is so expensive because they would so rarely be used that you have stranded capital. And third thing is, just takes a while to charge batteries. So you got a weight penalty that's enormous. You have electrical charging issues that force it to be hours and hours or overnight to recharge that battery. And so you just can't do it. You need to have liquid-fueled tractor trailers for moving goods on the nation's highways, for moving trains, and so on. So liquid fuels are here to stay in transportation. It'd be lovely to make them from renewable energy and at the same time be able to use them as a grid-level energy storage or and however you want to define grid level. Batteries are going to get used, but the bigger they are, the harder it is to make them safe, for one thing. An internal short circuit's really bad news. But more importantly, every cubic centimeter of a battery is going to be expensive. You can't make anything cheaper than a big steel tank in terms of an energy storage device. And finally, batteries lose their charge with time. But if I fill up a tank with ammonia, in 50 years, I will have every last drop of energy I put into it available to be used, as long as the tank doesn't leak. But on the scale problem, if you go back to energy storage of electricity, then really what you want to back up and think about is, what do you generate electricity with? How do you make significant amounts of electricity? Well, there are cogeneration plants in New Mexico and big industrial facilities now. So one would envision that the minimum size energy storage module, however you make it, would be something that goes with a standard industrial cogeneration facility. You don't want to think about photovoltaics because those are scattered and too small scale. And in fact, I think right now photovoltaics are not such great things on the utility grid because they're forcing us to shut down more efficient fossil fuel systems or make them run inefficiently because the energy from photovoltaics is coming in when we don't need it, especially in the summer in New Mexico.
There's also an issue with this could change, but the materials used to make photovoltaics, some of them are rare materials that limit the scale of what can even be done with them.
And the industrial consequences of the production of those materials in terms of carbon and energy and so on are not trivial. But it's lovely to think about a solar thermal electricity generating plant where you just have mirrors at a steam boiler. The sun boils the water, runs a steam turbine, turns a generator, makes electricity. That's 200-year-old technology.
So that's basically, it's the exact same thing as coal, but instead of burning coal, you're boiling water, you're using the sun to boil water.
And the nice thing about it is that it's factor of two more efficient than photovoltaics in making electricity. Just beat some hands down. And if you got 10 cloudy days, you could burn natural gas in the same system to run the same turbine. And if you're making a lot of if you have a lot of heat from the sun and not a big electrical load, you can run some of that steam and heat rocks in the ground. So during the evening and night, you can use that hot rocks to keep making steam to turn the turbine. So it's a really nice system that has some intrinsic storage in it.
Albert Migliori, so just based on all the things that you've said, if we look at your vision, we're talking about getting off of fossil fuels, getting on to renewable fuels, having electricity generated that both makes electricity that we use and makes liquid fuel that we can use for transportation and to burn to make more electricity. And when you think about the political will, the time frame, and the scale to do all of these things, even if we got the chemistry, it's still a daunting task.
It is, MC. This is a long haul, and it's going to take a very strong will by the people who pay for these developments, the American taxpayer, for one. They have to make up their minds to do this, and there's going to be some teething problems in switching over, and sometimes it's going to be expensive. But in the long run, we're pretty far along. We can make electricity from renewable sources. All we need to do is have the will to decide how much. We don't know how to store it yet, so we've got to make that science happen by being careful to fund it. It's not going to happen unless we do the research in chemistry and physics to figure out how to do this.
Now, you're doing that research.
I am doing a little bit of that research.
And is it being done in other countries? Or is Europe way ahead of us?
You know, there are a lot of really smart people all over the world thinking the same way I am. And it is not something we own exclusively here at Los Alamos or here in the United States. I hope somebody figures this out. I'd love it to be our team at Los Alamos, but I'd love it to be somebody in Germany or Japan or wherever as well.
If they do, or whoever does it, does that person then own that technology and get to sell it and get to make money off it, or does it become sort of the property of everybody?
You know, that's a complicated question. I think that there are issues with intellectual property law that today are not in the public, not in the public good at all. And one has to be extremely careful about that. But if these things start to yield scientifically, one hopes that will be as close to public property as possible. That's what I would like to see.
Albert Migliori is a physicist and laboratory fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, MC.